board. All right. We are now in the process of recording a podcast for future people around the world who will want to participate in our seminar. I am not proposing that we now, after every seminar, put online for anybody our ruminations. This is a one-shot deal for Rudolfo. I think it would be both incomprehensible to people to listen to the kind of roundtable discussion we have and interfere with the character of our own discussions. But
the bandwidth costs would bankrupt us.
Well, with an MP3, it's apparently even an hour, you know, a two-hour thing isn't that big a deal. It's going to be an MP3 online. It's not going to be a
streaming.
So this will either work or not work. I don't want to fuss with this part of it. And I'm going to give the other guy, well, he's still not online. So I guess Michael will probably at some point try to join us, and we'll see what happens.
Eric, do you want the camera?
Well, sure, I can just start the, as long as it's just you, you can just watch on the Skype video.
Oh, yeah.
Is it on?
Yes.
But now you're breaking up.
Okay, let's see. No, it should still be fine.
Now, your voice is all broken up and echoey now.
Well, then let's do it without the camera thing.
Now talk and see if you're okay.
Is it better now?
Yeah, that's better, isn't it? So maybe there's a bandwidth problem when we try to do too many things on the thing at the same time.
Okay.
I have no idea if this recording thing is still working, but we'll just have to see what happens. Okay. A couple of announcements. First of all, next week there's a Haven Center visitor, Ernst Fair. I've sent notices around to some of you. I don't think I did to everybody in this seminar yet. So let's pass this around. I would recommend that you come to see him if you can. He is a... oh, there's Michael. Michael?
Yeah.
Michael, are you there?
Hi, Eric. Yes.
Okay, I'm going to have to... let's see, now I think Fabian's on hold. Fabian, are you there? I think Fabian's been put on hold. So I'm going to try the conference call again. So you may get disconnected, but we'll do both at the same time.
I'll just sit here.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm starting the... Are you both there?
Yes.
Fabian, are you there?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm there.
Everybody can hear everybody. All right. Fabian, if you want to send me the, you know, the video message thing, I can click on that if you want to watch me too. But or we can just forget about it. It's up to you. I was discussing a visitor next week. Ernst Fair. I would recommend that you go to see him. He's extremely unusual in the kind of research he does. It's very provocative. He's a progressive guy who's concerned with the understanding more deeply the nature of human cooperation, altruism, and compliance to norms. And to approach this, he's looking at the neurobiological foundations of cooperation, not just the social and economic bases. So he's what's called a neuroeconomist, which is a very fringy thing in the economics profession. It deeply runs against the grain of the sort of simple rational choice, self-interested actor model of economics, but does so in a more foundational way than the typical carping of sociologists do, because it shows that we're hardwired to be not simple-minded, self-interested maximizers. I just think the stuff he does is extremely interesting. He's very clear, engaging, friendly guy. anyone who is interested and wants to participate in a informal catered dinner and then a much looser conversation around these themes, including people from the philosophy department, that will be held on Tuesday night. I need to know that you want to participate because we have 15 slots available for Haven Center sociology department folks. And we still have places, but if you want to do that, let me know. That would be Tuesday night at Richie Davidson's house. I'll give you the information if you want to do it. Okay, that's that announcement. Second announcement. Because of Fair's visit, I have to take him out to dinner on Monday night. Monday night is a fairly demanding evening for me. And therefore, I would request that this week you get your interrogations to me by Sunday rather than Monday. And if at all possible, earlier than 6 on Sunday. I'd rather not, you know, stay up as late as I need to when I do these things. So if you can just organize your lives so you can get them to me by early afternoon Sunday, then I will be able to cope with this particular weekend. The reading, there's less reading for next week. It's 3 relatively short pieces. They're murky, by my judgment, in any case. So it's not that it's simple reading, but it's not as much. I thought I should also just tell you a little bit about the context for next week's readings. First, I just want to check in. Both of you guys, the remote listeners, can you hear me okay?
Yes, perfect.
Michael, you're okay?
Yes, yes.
Okay, great. Just, since you're so politely quiet, I couldn't tell that this is all registering. So I just want to tell you just a little bit about the context for this, for next week's session. Resnick and Wolff are two very prominent sort of Marxist economists at the University of Massachusetts Amherst who are at the core of a particular tradition of Marxist work. It's a little hard to characterize it in some simple phrase. It's roughly thought of as post-structuralist Marxism of one sort or another. I find that tradition extremely difficult to sort out. So when they wrote this published critique of my work and I was asked to write a reply, I sat down to read their stuff and just found it hard to sort out. And I made my cost-benefit analysis, so to speak, of how much effort it would take me to read it carefully enough to find out what was interesting about it so that I could write a paper other than one that said, I can't make head nor tails of this, I'm completely clueless, people have to learn to express themselves in a more transparent way. That's a 4-sentence reply, right? You know, I make a point of not writing replies in which I basically just trash something. Unless I see the object of my reply as an enemy, which I don't see them as enemies. I mean, I see them on the same side of the great Manichaean struggle between darkness and light. And while I don't appreciate the kind of work they do, I don't want to be one of the people taking pot shots at it. And thus, I was prepared to write a critical response so long as I could also retrieve what was interesting from it, which I think I could do. I mean, I don't think it's beyond my capacities, but I wasn't prepared to do it. I didn't want to invest the time. So I decided when preparing the seminar, well, this would force me to come to terms with their work. And furthermore, I thought collectively we might have more intelligence about this than I do individually, and so I was hoping that we would use the seminar in part just to collectively try to make sense of it. Now, some of you may not find it so hard. I mean, I've had the experience, you know, people come from different coordinates, they have different intellectual things that they've been attached to. Some people have been more, both more exposed to and sympathetic to and bothered to learn the inner workings of postmodernist kinds of thinking than I have. And for them, this might not be so arduous. So that's the agenda. It's a different sort of session from the ones we have. It is definitely a tradition of class analysis that's alive and well. And two of the people who work in that tradition have in recent times become much, much clearer and more interesting. Julie Graham and Catherine Gibson. Or Julie, yeah, it's Julie Graham and Catherine Gibson. They go under
Julie Graham?
They go under the written name. They write together and they go J.K. Gibson Graham. J.K. Gibson hyphen Graham. So they publish under a joint author's name. They're two separate people. They've both been here as Haven Center visitors. They have recently been writing on what they call community economics. And about three quarters of it, I think, is terrific. And a quarter of it still has this kind of difficult stuff, which may be terrific as well. I don't mean to sound quite as judgmental as I am. Okay, that's next week. So get your interrogations to me as early as possible on Sunday, and I will start working on them sometime in the Sunday afternoon. All right. I don't think I have any other pre-discussion things to say. So let's go for it. Let me just reiterate that I thought these were excellent interrogations. Some of them were on the longish side, but I don't want to discourage you from writing long interrogations. And you shouldn't, those of you who didn't write long ones shouldn't feel like you're missing the boat by writing short, punchy ones. This is really an anything-goes terrain. The amount that I'm having to do is close to my limit. So far, the mix hasn't exceeded it. You know, it takes me about 6 hours or so to do the whole set. When it ends up being with my comments, about 28 single-space pages, which is what it's come to the last 2 weeks. I can handle that. If it jumped up to 35, it would probably tip me over the edge. So as long as the mix is about what it is now, I think we can continue. I think it would be good to begin with the cluster of issues around the concept of exploitation and how it figures in different ways in various themes that people have talked about. What I've done is grouped a bunch of the interrogations under that rubric. Now, the issue of exploitation only figured as one component of a cluster of issues, and for others it was central. And I'm not quite sure if the way I've parsed this is the optimal one. But these were issues raised in different ways by Elizabeth, Adrian, Anne, Johannes, Asaf, and Rahul. So it's a big chunk of you were asking questions about this. So let's begin with we can go down these bullet points, but they may not, we may naturally segue just as we discuss from one to another. It may not be the case that we'll stick with this order. So the first issue, which I think was raised most explicitly by Elizabeth, but it comes up in different ways in some of the other comments as well, is about the relationship of the concept of definition, the concept of exploitation to the problem of surplus, and can we really have a notion of exploitation that's just based on the idea of effort extraction, which is the way I've come to formulate it, and appropriating the fruits of labor, the products of labor, without an explicit characterization of that in terms of a appropriation of the surplus? And does that really matter? Is that just a rhetorical difference, not a substantive one? Does anything really hinge on that contrast? That's just a way of talking about the general concept of exploitation. And then we can move to the more specific issues, many of which centered around the issue of skills and their connection to exploitation, and also the concept I talk about as loyalty rents as relevant to the problem of exploitation. Okay, that's my stage setting. Elizabeth, if you want to just say something first, since that first issue was one that you raised, and then other people can join in.
Okay, well, I guess part of where I was coming from was feeling like your argument against surplus was an argument about the difficulties in operationalizing it, against the idea that exploitation is appropriation of surplus. And it seemed to me both that it needn't be that hard to operationalize, but also that the replacement ideas seemed equally difficult to operationalize. And I thought that the ideas about, for example, is the economic oppressor, do they need the continued existence of the other, of the economically oppressed being a test for exploitation, was at least as difficult to operationalize in a way that wouldn't be too permissive about what exploitation is, as would a concept of appropriation of surplus. I don't know how helpful that is to start.
Can you repeat that last sentence?
Yeah, I thought that, so the replacement for appropriation of surplus is supposed to be some idea of appropriation of effort, right? And so the way that that was operationalized, I think, was supposed to be the test of would-be exploiter need the continued effort of the would-be exploited, and or need their existence. And I guess I felt like that either amounts to it needs them because it's extracting surplus, some kind of surplus, or I think it amounts to something vaguer that I found overly permissive, and that's where I think it turned into an argument about whether unemployed or exploited.
Now, I mean, one way of characterizing it is that appropriating effort is all that's at stake in the notion of appropriating surplus once you drop the labor theory of value. That is, if you also have the labor theory of value, then there's a quantitative relationship between the extraction of effort and the value that's available to be turned into profits through the equations of the labor theory of value, which goes through the notion of the surplus. So the function of the specific concept of the surplus was to provide this bridge between a notion of extracting effort from people and the rate of profit. If you drop the labor theory of value for various reasons, and you ask, what's really generating the antagonism here, the conflict, and therefore the potential coalitions and fractures and different interests that actors have with respect to this total process, then it may really just amount to how people relate to the effort they expend and the control and appropriation of the fruits of that effort, regardless of whether or not we then also relabel that in the aggregate a surplus, so that nothing is added by that additional labeling to the process. If you frame it as effort extraction, then the issue of people who aren't performing effort, the unemployed, let's say, becomes, I think, perhaps clearer, so that they may be necessary for the reproduction of a system because of their role in disciplining labor. But employers don't have to worry about extracting effort from them. They have to worry about extracting effort from actual workers, and they use the unemployed to facilitate that. But they don't have to worry about the extraction of effort from the unemployed. And thus the unemployed bear a different relationship to the exploitation process than do the employed workers.
So I don't have any disagreement with that, so I think the disagreement actually is about the labor theory of value.
Okay. So if the disagreement is about the labor theory of value, then it may be worthwhile to spend a little bit of time just talking about that and whether or not there's any particular reason to hold on to that for other than exegetical reasons. There may be reasons why it's a useful heuristic for certain purposes, but as an actual explanatory structure. Rahul, were you?
I was not originally thinking of responding to on the labor theory value specifically. Yeah. Should I say what I was going to say?
Yeah, we can backtrack and then.
I was going to say in response, I guess, that I very much like the slippage away from the narrow focus on simply who owns the means of production to talking about the way that you can extract, call it what you will, some sort of surplus based on a privileged position with regard to crucial assets, capital being one of them, but as you say, organization being another one. That in fact, in a sort of ideal case, you could actually imagine someone who plays many of the roles of a capitalist and actually helps to increase production, but does it without actually having any capital. And there, if they are extracting the surplus, it is because of their privileged position with regard to the organization of production, of means of production that others have. Or you could look like Romer does at this isomorphism between a situation where it's all about a labor market to another one where it's all about a credit market. You could imagine a situation in which capital is extremely common and labor is extremely rare. Let's say most people are invalids, but they all own some means of production. In such a situation, you could actually get to a completely reverse situation where the person with means of production has to sell their, let's call it, capital power, and for an exchange value much less than what it can produce, given the relatively rare supply of labor. And it's actually those who have the supply of labor who benefit. It's all about what actually turns out to be the scarce resource, and of course, what are the underlying social, institutional, legal structures that enforce your rights over those scarce resources. So I actually found that part to be extremely useful. That segues into a criticism, which is I think that it's very good to get away from Marx's very narrow, coherent conception, which is about basically you have one industrial plant in the universe, and there is production there, and there is then surplus value, surplus labor value is extracted by the capitalist. Once you move beyond that and consider the embeddedness in society, then remaining with Marx's very narrow definition gives, as I mentioned last time, gives you very perverse results. In particular, it tries to give workers a great deal of credit for working with highly capitalized industries as opposed to lesser capitalized industries. It just seems to me that once you get beyond that and try to look at exploitation in a larger framework, in the societal framework rather than in the one of an individual firm, I don't see any theoretical reason or analytical reason you give for expanding the boundaries this much and no further, not sort of creating a new integral coherent view of exploitation that takes into account all social relations rather than those just at an individual point of production.
Well, I suppose the reason why I myself didn't do that expansion is I didn't see how to do it without losing track, losing control over the concepts, and in which it would then end up dissolving the class character of those concepts into just a more generic notion of inequality. In the way that, so for example, the multiple oppressions perspective on inequality tends to do. You have a long list of ways in which advantages built into social relations and social mechanisms, and there's no principled basis for restricting the set. My view with respect to that has been that, yes, we don't want to restrict the set, so we want to give full recognition to race and nationality and uneven development, all the other ways in which inequalities are systematically structured, but that I wanted the concept of class not to be the encompassing one, for which then we would need a bunch of sub-concepts to deal with the particular mechanisms.
But you add two oppressions, but no more. You add to the oppression of the ownership of capital, you add the privilege with regard to organizational assets and credentials, but then no more.
Okay, so the organizational ones I consider a disaggregation of the basic ownership relationships. So I don't consider the managerial dimension of this problem. I don't consider adding anything. It's a disaggregation of a previously unified notion. So there was a time when the owners of the means of production were also the managers of the means of production, and we've now differentiated that task. That represents a differentiation within a particular kind of social relationship. That was in the original formulation of contradictory class locations. We are now hearing a phone ringing in some distant land.
Sorry, that's Philadelphia.
I think you should turn off your microphone except when you want to talk, because we hear, it's not just the telephone, it's just we hear whatever other noises. Okay, that's better. Of course, then we don't know that you're still there, so you have to periodically say something, otherwise we'll think you died.
Okay.
Okay. So the managerial part, I didn't see as adding an additional element. The skills part, which is the next sort of cluster of things we want to talk about, and we can sort of segue there and then segue back to labor theory of value, since actually they're connected in a way. The skills part did represent an importation of a different kind of problem. In some ways, it was the importation of the Weberian problem inside of the Marxian framework. And I think what one should, the way to look at it is that the formulation in the book Classes was a kind of experiment that I don't think was in the end successful. That is, this multiple exploitations view where we had skill exploitation, organization exploitation, and capital exploitation as three mechanisms of exploitation, to which one could add many others. I don't think in the end that's a satisfactory way of treating skills. And subsequently, in Class Counts, I did pull back from that, and I more treat skills as a stratification variable within a common class location. It still creates a kind of contradictory location because of the way in which it places people in a different relationship to the process of exploitation by giving them these sort of rent components, which softens or reduces the exploitative character of their positions, gives them privileges with respect to exploitation. But I no longer treat it as a distinctive type of exploitation as I did in that earlier formulation.
Can I follow up with
you? Yeah.
That's very good, because that actually, that definitely answers some of the questions I had about why you were going the direction you were going. But I think maybe I can clarify some of these questions in terms of an example. With regard to this, I mean, you want to retain a concept of exploitation that links it to class formation, and even to class struggle. And in that regard, I mean, think of the example of, there's this general, I think, Marxist conception that so-called skilled workers, usually higher wage workers, are actually more militant than lower wage workers, and insofar as that's actually looking at a cause rather than an effect, the argument is that they are more militant because, you know, for one reason or another, they work in higher capitalized industries, and thus the total extraction of surplus from them is greater, and because of that, very often, in fact, the relative extraction of surplus from the skilled workers is actually greater, and that's a pretty general idea that's somehow, through some mechanism that's unspecified, what leads to greater class consciousness. I would actually flip that around and say that the reason is rather that they're in a privileged position, and that if they do organize, there's a relative shortage of that kind of labor, they're much more likely to be able to get concessions from the capitalist rather than simply being replaced the way lower skill workers are, and that's why they're more militant, because there's more returns to it. And these two sort of kind of opposite explanations of that link seem to go to very much to this question of how much you want to try to link exploitation and class directly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they have to be conscious in a certain way because they are somehow a good which has to be more scarce than normal labor in order to get a part of the surplus share. And then I was starting to think about Marx by himself, I think, was not putting so much emphasis on the middle class. I mean, he was maybe just avoiding to look so much on them or ignoring it. And I think that was because of his general idea that there will be competition, and because of competition, such scarce labor will get more supply, and then this extra rent they get will go down to the normal wage all the other workers are becoming. And that's why I think this rent somehow is only possible because they have to be organized, they have to keep themselves scarce, maybe in the form that they restrict education, or that they that there are certain mechanisms, like if you're a manager, you don't tell the secrets of the company, and therefore you get something extra, and that this nobody else is getting the secret knowledge and things like that, so that they have to establish also something, I would say, in the superstructure or in how the society is organized to keep this rent going. And but you can maybe argue that in the long term no such middle classes may be able to keep up this privilege or this rent because there will always be people who maybe also gain that knowledge or that education. And so yeah, maybe that's why they are more willing to rebel, maybe if they have fear to lose their privilege.
I don't think in terms of the skilled workers, I don't think it's just a question of scarcity, but if you're talking about in a higher, in a more capitalized workplace, a higher rate of exploitation, I think that's the argument that I would see for why they there would be more effective struggles is that if there's a higher rate of exploitation, the capitalists have more to lose with the cessation of their work. And I feel like that's that was an important contribution of this week's reading compared to last week, which is looking at the effects of exploitation, not just in terms of consciousness, but also in terms of the power to withhold labor and struggle that way. And I guess I don't see any kind of plausible mechanism that I can think of why there would be a direct connection between increased, you know, the level of exploitation in that technical sense and consciousness, other than via, you know, the effectiveness of struggle. I do think, though, that there might be a correlation between what you might have called skilled labor, especially certain kinds of skilled labor, and the way that production is organized with regard to things like how collective is it, that I could imagine affecting consciousness as well.
The if we're concerned with the concept of the intensity of exploitation in a way that connects to people's lived experience as opposed to some equation on a table, on a piece of paper, then the extraction of effort view of exploitation makes more sense than the labor theory of value view. The labor theory of value view gives you these completely non-experiential facts that sweatshop workers are less exploited than highly skilled computer programmers, which does not make sense from an experiential point of view. That is, the sense that you're constantly under pressure to perform more effort and somebody else is benefiting in it and appropriating the fruits of that effort is certainly greater in a sweatshop than in a typical engineering context. And it's because the labor effort extraction and the value extraction are different ideas. But if the point of it is to explain something about the nature of conflict and the nature of antagonism and the polarization of interests that gets generated by that, I think the effort extraction view is the more general one and the more useful one. And that nothing is lost by dropping the labor theory of value reformulation of the effort extraction perspective. Yes, I have.
So I agree with you that, you know, what you're saying about it makes more intuitive sense, right, for someone to experience effort extraction rather than surplus, because I would say that it's probably the odd worker who's actually calculating the difference between, you know, rate of profit and their wage and this and that. You know, it's part of the thing, right? It's very hard to see the systemic characteristics of capitalist exploitation. But how do we apply that idea of effort extraction to understanding that that's actually having a particular effect? Because it's an experiential concept, and that's something that we should be able to get in some way in those other sorts of, I don't know, data. I'm not totally concerned this is a purely, like, empirical issue, but, like, how do we apply it other than using it as a different word than surplus and exploitation? And just saying, well, I've really reworked the same concept, but I'm now using words that make more intuitive sense.
I mean, I don't have an answer to the metric question, but it's how do you measure how much effort is extracted? I mean, that's a difficult question. The labor theory of value doesn't help you with that either. So, I mean, you still, the same issue applies to labor theory of value. You have to measure abstract labor time and abstract labor effort, and nobody has a clue how to do that either. So I don't, that's a generic issue about this labor process-centered view of extraction, whether it's the performance of abstract labor by workers in the form of value or just the performance of effort. So I can't give you an operational strategy for measuring variations in it. We can surely, however, observe all sorts of consequences of this as a central problem, the way in which surveillance systems get set up, the ways in which reservation wages fit into efficiency wage rents and so on for creating incentives for workers to work hard and not shirk because of the cost of job loss. I mean, all of that's about effort extraction. So the idea of effort extraction helps one to understand lots of aspects of how the actual organization of labor, of the labor process and of work and surveillance, and the complexities of it under conditions where labor effort isn't observable. You know, it helps to explain why you get job ladders for certain kinds of work and not for others. So I do think it's an explanatorily rich idea, and it does help to connect the older language of exploitation to more contemporary discussions of things like efficiency wages and the like. Matt, you, and then Elizabeth.
Oh, first an anecdote.
This is Matt Nichter, by the way. Not everybody knows him. He's an old hand in this department, and he's an interloper for a few weeks. So.
Anyways, oh, just an anecdote, by the way. I worked in an office when I was a temp, and part of my job was to actually open the mail. So I actually saw how much the company I was being contracted to paid the temp agency. I knew exactly how exploited it was because I saw that they paid me $12 an hour and they paid the temp agency $30 an hour. I wasn't highly supervised, or, you know, there was no one whipping me with a lash, but I just think the relationship between the, you know, level of exploitation and immediate domination, it can be pretty loose, and it depends on a lot of contextual factors. You can, even if you work in a sweatshop, your relation to the actual capitalist, you know, who's ending up with the surplus, I mean, that someone else is ending up with, it's clear, but who it is and where it is might be quite opaque. So I just think it's, anyway, I want to come back. I think I noticed in class counts there is a shift back and forth between this idea of appropriating effort, which to me is a metaphor. You don't actually appropriate effort. You appropriate, you try to, because you can get effort out of people and you appropriate stuff.
Right.
So between appropriating effort and appropriating fruits of labor, which is also used in some of the early work, I think in big ways, and also appropriation of surplus. And here's where I think you're forced back to talk about appropriation of surplus. It comes when you're dealing with skills. You want to be able to say that skilled workers can be exploiters, but they may not be. They may be merely lessening their own exploitation by, you know, by exerting some monopoly power, what have you, right? But then the question becomes, okay, well, how do you know? You need to be able to compare what they're getting paid, in fact, through hook or by crook, with something else. And then the something else is this, so you offer fairly complicated, to me, arguably not even coherent, counterfactual situations. What would happen in this ideal labor market? It's not a perfect general equilibrium situation. It's And we can get into details. But what I think what the way out of this really is or what points back to is there's no way to dodge the issue of sort of what's the value of what's being created. And I think that the real comparison is for a skilled worker, it's not so much are they getting paid more than it would cost to reproduce them hypothetically in some ideal, again, something I can't quite get my head around. The question is, how much value are they creating and how much are they getting paid? If the skilled worker is actually getting paid more than they actually create, or likewise the CEO, that was the problem, that's where you initially introduced the problem, surplus again, is we're talking, I want to know, as a CEO, are they exploited or are they exploiting? Well, the certain CEO gets paid $1 million, but they really don't contribute $1 million to, again, how exactly you operationalize and measure creational value, we can debate, whether it's through labor theory and how operationalizable that is, or something else. But I just don't think there's any way around this problem. You haven't gotten out of it. You're forced to move from expropriation of effort back to appropriation of surplus, and you need to be able to define that, and I think it's better to talk about creation rather than, once you start talking about deviations from ideal labor power reproduction, you're actually getting down the road of Sorensen and sort of which you don't want to go. I think this is all leading back in some ways to where this all debate started. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that as soon as you have a second circuit of distribution where you have something which let's for the moment call surplus that gets redistributed in the form of wages to people. So the CEO gets a redistribution of something produced elsewhere. Then it's hard not to use that kind of language to it. And so I think what you're regarding perhaps correctly as confusion in my segueing back and forth between different idioms, just reflects the tension in trying to have a single way of talking about these interconnected processes. Probably I wasn't careful enough.
But you were trying to avoid the issue of surplus by going to extraction of effort, but you're forced, when you're dealing with
these other sorts of categories,
to resort back to this. Right. Yeah, right. And the question is, has what you introduced, this idea, I mean, it's only just developed in like a page and a half, or not even like a half a page, about, you know, you go through the three possible alternatives, a sort of counterfactual ideal labor market, but it's still capitalism, there's still some extraction of effort, so it's not really perfect information, which is what you'd need to get rid of all effort. It's just a situation, I don't even know that there even exist models of this. I think that's something that's a non-starter. Why not talk about not these ideal conditions of ideal costs of reproduction under a fantasy circumstance, but what people are actually contributing in the real world. Again, hard to measure, but it's a clear, conceptually, clear.
It's not so clear conceptually either as part of the problem.
Okay.
It's not clear conceptually what it means for a person to contribute. Does it mean how much more value is there in the world by virtue of things that they've done than if they hadn't done them? Well, that can't be what we mean by it, because it could certainly be the case that a clever CEO, by making the right decision, has resulted in $10 million more worth of value existing in the world than if he hadn't made that decision. As one can say, yes, he's the person responsible for making decision X. Decision X results in that much greater value being created in the world. Well, we don't want to attribute it all to that person making that decision, because in order for that decision to have led to that much value, a whole lot of other things also had to happen. It may be true that without the CEO doing it, it wouldn't have happened, and therefore that's why he's a valuable.
And this is a problem with every existing theory, about, including the sort of marginal utility.
Right, so it's a complete...
Trying to measure a real worker's marginal productivity, good luck. But there's no special problem pertaining to any particular economic theory.
Yeah. Is that here, or is that... That's in...
It sounds like it's through this.
In some distant places. Very interesting. Elizabeth, at one point, I don't know if you... We're responding to something Matt was saying.
I was going to say something that I think is very similar to what Matt is saying, which is that it seems to me that there's two different concepts being talked about here that ought to be separated from one another, and one is the kind of what best explains people's lived experiences, what I would be more inclined to call like economic oppression, and the other is a question of value, and I guess where I think that we're disagreeing is about whether the question of value is also explanatory, because I feel like you don't need that as directly to explain consciousness, but I think you do need it to explain power, and the power that exploitation gives, and why it is that actually the experience of oppression doesn't correspond necessarily neatly to the power that, that people have in the workplace. And you have parts of industry that are more or less strategic sites for organizing because of, I think, because of the value that they produce, independent of what kind of domination is there and how horrible it feels to work there. And that's why I feel like you need a concept of value as well.
Bravo.
Yeah, to I guess follow up and respond to Matt and to Eric. I mean, I think that as Eric's example shows, I mean, this is exactly what how mainstream economics looks at these things. Labor is an input, capital is an input. If you look at the marginal extra production because of capital as an input, you get some larger amount than you do, you know, with the right metric. If you look at the marginal extra production with labor as an input, and therefore the capitalist is getting, you know, what share he or she contributes. And that's, if you're going to try to simply look at what any given person contributes without any presuppositions, I think that's all you can end up with. And in fact, you're going to end up with basically accepting whatever mystifications go into economic processes in capital society and simply taking that as your normative framework. Now, I think there are some problems with the labor theory of value, and it's certainly true that the way Marx stated it is, it's not at all intuitively obvious that it's the case, and it's not clear to me, I think, what are really the presuppositions behind it. Certainly Marx doesn't make it clear, but if you don't have something like that, Marx has a simple solution to that basic question, which is to say that simply count labor as the source of all value, and so everything else, all other inputs, are in a sense socially or politically less important. Not because you don't need them, you do need them, but because I think there's some sort of basic generic sense that if they didn't come from here, they would come from somewhere else, that it doesn't particularly matter in terms, at least in the normative framework he's looking at, where they come from, and that the only thing that's not, you know, that's not so easily transferable like that is labor, and the only thing who's in the end, in the final analysis, whatever exactly the hell that means, in the final analysis, it's only those conditions which require the expenditure of labor power that actually create the social and political consequences that you can then sort of try to frame economically. To me, actually, the labor theory of value, insofar as it has any value, is actually a statement very much about his political sensibilities about the way that the capitalist economy works. Now, it's not literally true. I mean, it is true that there are times when a capitalist actually does provide some necessary capital, which wasn't going to be provided elsewhere, especially if you take a case of an invention or something, which wouldn't necessarily have happened. And in those cases, I mean, there's certainly at least deviations from a labor theory of value. But I don't see any way to get to an accurate valuation that doesn't just sort of accept the dollar exchange rates of everything that we have in the economy without starting from something like that and at least trying to see where are the flaws in it, what are the kinds of extensions you want to make. But if, as you say, you need a metric, I don't see another starting point. I think if you do have that as a starting point, you'll actually come to different conclusions than Marx did about the labor value relation in differently capitalized industries, because I don't think he sort of extended his political analysis far enough, but I do think that's the only place to start.
I think for two reasons we need to move on from this particular cluster, although we'll come back to it various times. One is that we have lots of other things on our list. And the other is that so far only a few people have been participating in the discussion, and I think this particular face of the relationship between class and exploitation is one that not everyone is as fully engaged in. So this isn't meant to say that we've come to a resolution on these weighty matters. I think it would be within this first block, there was the question raised by a number of people about unemployment and perhaps the underclass and the like, and what, how we should think about that relationship to class. Adrian raised the issue about skill exploitation and socialism, but I think
that's a personal question.
No, it's a real question of importance. Let's talk a little bit about the status of unemployment with respect to the class analysis and what it, within the broad parameters of the framework that I argued for, within which I think you can either rewrite it in terms of the labor theory of value or not. It wouldn't affect this particular set of arguments. So somebody who posed that cluster, yeah.
I'm still having difficulty with understanding. I mean, I guess,
announce who you are for our out of towners.
I'm Anne. I guess I understand the point that basically the underclass are marginalized then, and that's kind of all. That's what I feel like this theory, kind of all it can say is that because they don't, their production or their labor power isn't valued or there's no need for it, that they're just kind of outside the system. And I feel like there needs to be something more that the theory of class or can say about a whole group of people than that they're just sort of marginalized and out of the system. And I don't know how then they would ever get power to get in the system, or maybe nobody. I mean, I understand the point. I had actually written it before I got to your point, that they could just be put into prisons, because really, which is, you know, I think often what happens, but, and I'm not sure if there's an answer to it, and I'm not sure if other conceptions of class explain it better, and, you know, maybe we'll see as we go through if I can find a way, and this is sort of new to me, thinking about class in these different ways. So I'm just kind of struggling with it still, and is how do they fit then, because exploitation requires that, you know, the labor requires labor.
Yeah,
Asa. I'll start from what I wrote, and I will try to see where the connection to your question or your comment. I thought that we shouldn't look on the unemployed as one group. There are different groups within unemployed people, those who don't want to work at all, whatever the reason they have, sometimes with they're been labeled as chronically unemployed, and then they might be considered as this group. Maybe considered as a group that is not needed, or the underclass. The second group is unemployed who are looking for a job. They want to work. They are temporarily unemployed for different reasons. Either they chose not to work, or they are switching jobs. It's a woman that was pregnant and she took a leave, and then we can consider them as the first group, to think that they're not necessary to the market, or that they are not exploited, since their existence changed the bargaining power of the employed. And there, haven't they been there, all the workers that might have been replaced by them would have been irreplaceable, and their bargaining power is greater, and then the capitalists would need them in order to exploit more the workers. Okay. That's why they are either passively exploited or potentially exploited once they will be in the market. The third group is the group in a market when there is unemployment benefits social welfare that pays unemployment benefits, and then we can say that the benefits that they get, this group gets, is come from the fruits of the, either the working class, or sometimes even the capitalist, although we can argue whether it's their labor or not, but it's from their fruits. So they are exploiting all the working people. In a way, I think that underclass, if we look at what it will, it might cost what it might cost to society, all the people that do work, either to keep them alive or to kill them all. So it might be prisons, but it might be, but why prison? What kind of threat do they have on us? So it might, there might be, I think, an economically a reason why to pay them, to give them an ability to live, to have a minimum way of living.
Adrian.
I was going to respond to the third class that Asaf, or the third, not class, but category. The idea that some people who are not currently involved or engaged in the labor market and who are not working have the ability to do so because the state provides them with some sort of social welfare. In so doing, I mean, I guess the way I would look at it with underemployed people or unemployed people, you can approach it and say that's inefficiency of the market itself or inefficiency of capital because it's not employing all of the labor that it could possibly. If you have a large portion of people that are not currently engaged in that market, then you need to be able to offer them something to appease them in order to not think about why they too are not participating in that endeavor. And I think that that's one of the primary reasons why welfare of all sorts is provided, that it neutralizes the potential for a disruption of some kind. And in that way, I think, I mean, just like what the question asks, does capital need unemployed? Absolutely, as Asaf said. You want to pit two groups of workers or entities against one another, those who have jobs, those who don't. And you can use, like, the carrot or the stick to determine who, how are you going to get people to commit or to accept the yoke of being exploited and oppressed versus just, I guess, potentially oppressed rather than exploited also.
Something else I was thinking about that's related to this is you know, the drug markets and the, you know, people in the underclass who may, like, how that, you know, selling drugs to the capitalists. I guess it doesn't quite fit exploitation, I would guess, because you're not getting labor back from the capitalists. But I don't know, I think, you know, how drug markets are, is that contributing to, you know, keeping people kind of deadened in their oppression and their exploited, you know, in other groups. But I thought that was an interesting way of maybe of having some power, of having these gangs and, you know, keeping control of other people in the that are marginalized.
In terms of the analysis of class relations and exploitation, the distinction between whether the activity is legal or illegal seems to me of secondary importance. There are well-organized illegal markets that have employees who are exploited, who do the work of whatever work there is within that sector. In prostitution, in drugs, in the illegal production of perfectly legal products, so that there's illegal production in the sense that it's not registered, it doesn't pay taxes, it's in construction, in clothing, and all sorts of things. So the workers who perform the labor and are under the control of supervisors within enterprises that generate profits are workers in those firms. The fact that they're illegal, of course, changes their relationship to collective struggles in various ways. They're vulnerable in ways that other workers aren't. So that there's lots of variation in along that dimension, and I would not, in the first instance, give any make a distinction between tobacco, alcohol, and marijuana with respect to labor process exploitation, profit making. Although, of course, it does matter that some are legal and some aren't. That would matter a lot for understanding class struggles, collective action, and so on. Yes?
I was just wondering, in terms of unemployment, how do we put self-employment? Like, when we talk about unemployment, we're usually talking about employment in an organized labor market. However, there are sectors, like, at least in my country, in India, like 80% of the labor is working in unorganized, in the unorganized labor market, and they're self-employed, and there are elements of illegality maybe, but there are also elements of legality, and for example, women in the U.S. who are on welfare but working on, for example, as you know, opening up salons in their own houses, and then getting the money from there. And simultaneously on welfare, and then so I mean what I'm saying is that how do we conceptualize employment, unemployment, and work in these you know, fragmented?
So there's several interesting different components there. Let's take them one at a time, you know, rather than as a package. So consider self-employment. How do we think about how should we think about self-employment in class terms, within, since we're talking about my confused body of work or coherent body of work, depending upon one's taste, today, how is it dealt with within this particular framework of class analysis, self-employment?
Well, it's part of the middle, meaning that you obviously, being self-employed doesn't mean that you can compete with other capitalist. So you own your own, my understanding was you own your own means of production, but you're not producing, but you have no, well, it depends. Do you have employees or don't you?
Do you have employees or don't you?
No, you don't.
You're
and
just
you don't
employing yourself?
You own the means of production as well, you know. There are situations where they don't own almost anything, but, for example, they buy something from somebody, then sell it in the open market. And so they're very complex, they're basically unemployed, and yet they're self-employed in some way, with no employees, or employers. And I mean, and there are situations like that.
Fabian, you can jump in on this. You have thoughts on this.
Well, can you hear me well?
Yeah.
Yes. I actually thought about raising this point too in regard to, for example, you know, another developing region, Latin America. If you, and this is, I thought it might be too specific, but actually I thought about doing empirical work with a class scheme in one of those countries, and you really run into the problem that 80% of your sample don't fit anywhere. So I don't have a real, I'd be interested in the solution, but because I see this as really a pressing issue in other countries. But I don't have any take on that yet.
Can't they fall in and out of those categories? Can't they fall in and out of those categories? Like move, because they're locate, I mean, your location isn't permanent. You can move in and out of locations. So aren't they going to, I mean, I know you talked, maybe it's only applicable in like career track ideas, but can't the situation that Sarbani just talked about, can't it involve, yeah, the movement or falling in and out of either the job market or not? And how, and so you don't have a fixed class position at all, really. At least in terms of maybe generating like class consciousness in that way. I wouldn't consider anyone to be a capitalist.
Okay, so let's hold that idea as one element that we want to talk about, that is the temporal stability of a person's position. This comes up in other questions as well. And that people can have weak attachments to any particular class position statically defined because their lives are organized in such a way that they move in and out of positions. And one example of that would be the one we were just talking about. This particular form of self-employment can be something you move into and out of or combine with various forms of employment. Let's keep that as one element of trying to understand the class character of self-employment. There were a couple of other hands up, Adam.
Well, so I was just wondering, I forget where you talked about it, but the issue of thinking about post-structural or post-capitalist economies or post-Fordist economies a little bit differently in terms of how it works. And I'm wondering if something similar could be done for issues of informal labor markets. And the reason why I'm thinking about this was because, you know, maybe in the past year there was an article in ASR on sex segregation and occupations in developing countries. And so I was interested in how they were doing it. And you realize a lot of the sample falls out or is coded in a very odd way because of the fact the surveys that were set up to do this really had very little sense of what it meant to work in a lot of these countries. And so what I'm wondering is if maybe we're applying the wrong framework for some of these issues simply because we're trying to make kind of the capitalist framework work in an instance where the market and the economy simply does not function in the same way that we might assume under capitalism.
But I'd just like to respond to that it is not a primary phenomenon of so-called developing countries, because I was going through a lot of transcripts of women who are on welfare, and they almost everybody worked through home. They all had sources of income, which were informal, so to say, and not under organized labor market. So, and that was very difficult for me to understand. And so, and they have multiple sources. So not only did they were working, so to say, but they also were getting money from their, you know, partners or erstwhile partners because they left them. And so, I mean, so these money sources and their placement in an overall class structure, especially when there is so-called feminization of poverty, you know, so how do you place these women who are on welfare and yet have multiple sources of income vis-a-vis women or men who don't have those sources of, so this is not very typical of developing countries.
I didn't mean to say that it was typical developing. That's just what made me think about it, because I had spoken to someone who had done a lot of qualitative research on it and had a lot of problems with the way survey instruments were used to do things like occupational definitions, and it happened to be that in this instance. But my thought was is that if we can think about there being multiple economic structures that overlap, like the idea of, I forget whether it's capitalist, post-capitalist, or whatever the framework used there, but thinking about maybe some other overlapping structure.
So we've used a number of different expressions to capture this notion of there being multiple forms of economic structure overlapping in which people live their lives. And we can't locate them in a class structure without first understanding how these different forms of economic structures interconnect. The main language we've used is formal-informal. That may not be the best language for actually capturing this phenomenon, because the drug trade is informal but highly organized and certainly has employees in it. I mean, it functions very much like capitalist firms of a peculiar sort.
Soldiers.
So various people have proposed different ways of giving you a map of the kinds of economic structures in which people participate. Within each of those economic structures, we then define the set of positions that people occupy. And then an individual's life combines these in various ways, both statically, people can have multiple insertions at a given time, and dynamically, over time people move around this sort of structure. I was just given the fact that in the United States today, roughly 1 million people earn their major source of livelihood by being intermediaries on eBay. It's increased to that amount. As intermediaries in the sense that they have a shingle out, you know, either by word of mouth or actually a sign out on their house saying, I will sell things for you on eBay for a 5% commission. So you have something that you want to sell. You can't cope with the doing it the first time, because if you could manage to cope with it doing it once, you could then do it yourself. But the barriers to entry are large cognitively for many people. Or that they don't have broadband connection, whatever. And so people have set this up, and there's a million people now who make most of their standard of living doing that. Now, they're certainly self-employed. Nobody's paying them a wage. They're operating in a market, so we know what kind of economy are they in. They're in a market economy. They're selling a service. They're buyers of that service, and they make contracts. They are not... Some self-employed people are kind of crypto employees. That is, it is the case under current rules about subcontracting in the United States. I think this is true in all capitalist economies. It takes different forms in different places. It's sometimes to the advantage of an employer to call the employees self-employed subcontractors for various tax reasons and other issues. You don't have to pay Social Security, for example. They're responsible for their own Social Security payments. But in effect, they're really employees. That sort of pseudo self-employment, that would be a case where the appearance of self-employment disguises something else. I think these eBay intermediaries are genuinely self-employed, and there's a peculiar market that's new. It's a historically new market. There's been a long-standing market in secondhand goods. It's new that this is a mass market of a networked variety, where as opposed to a secondhand furniture store, which is the older form. So that would be the way you would describe the eBay self-employed person, is by saying, yes, they are in a market relation. They are themselves not in capitalist firms. They're in a kind of simple merchant commodity exchange economy in which they're self-employed, and therefore they are what would be classically called petty bourgeois. It's a particular kind of small self-employed person who is quite autonomous, schedules their own activities, not under anybody's surveillance, and making money through exchange relations. Yeah?
Well, isn't there classically a distinction between petty bourgeoisie and merchant capital? And petty bourgeoisie own their own means of production. Right. I'm not sure if the eBay folks do, because they have a computer. But merchant capital, you know, they buy cheap and sell dear, is essentially what eBay
does. So they're, well, it's not that eBay doesn't do that.
No, you, the eBay.
You're just getting a commission off of a trade between two people. You're not buying anything.
Well, eBay itself, I mean, is different.
Neither eBay doesn't make any, eBay makes it all on the transactions, not on, they don't buy anything.
They have a massive workforce.
Oh, yeah, they have an infrastructure.
They do trading.
Right. They're a trading house, and they exploit the employees of eBay, but they make most of their money off of the transaction costs from PayPal. That's, you know, they get a very small commission. It's just that it's such a big, you know, set of transactions. I mean, that's neither here nor there.
They're already extracting value from other people because they can't, because they have a monopoly position. They're the main portal.
Right.
But the issue is what these people that sort of spend their lives, you know, digging through the garbage and reselling something, or if you like, you know, sitting at your house and reselling all your old tchotchkes on eBay. You're buying cheap and selling dear in a classical sense. It's a little different from the petty bourgeoisie that actually, like, you run a family, you know, restaurant. You actually produce something. You own your own means of production. So I'm just saying there's a little difference between the petty bourgeoisie and
merchant
capital.
Well, the self-employed eBay intermediary who has a neighbor who wants to sell a tape recorder, and they do it for them.
He's selling a skill, then.
Yeah,
they
have a skill, and they're adding value because it takes the actual information transfers and coordination activity is labor, I would argue. That is, this economic transaction can't occur without that occurring. And they make money on a commission on it. They're not exactly buying cheap in selling deer.
So they're like lawyers or doctors.
Yeah, they're not actually buying
anything. I don't go on eBay that much. I'm thinking probably about Craigslist or something.
Yeah, in any case, all I was saying that's one type. You know, what I think we need to really explore deeply this issue, what you have to do is get a typology that is a set of types of economic relations or economic structures, and then locate people within them, and then understand how these connect. The incredibly marginalized self-employed peddler who gets from some wholesaler a consignment of chewing gum and sells it on the street by the stick, you know, what you see in third world countries. Well, they are kind of self-employed. That is, to get the consignment, they have to upfront some kind of resource. If they are doing it on consignment without having to put up anything in advance, then they're basically employees in a marginal firm. They're street vendors working for someone else on commission. If they have to buy from the wholesaler, the chewing gum, then they have to have had some kind of capital. It could be from friends, it could be from family, it could be from theft, whatever, or savings from the previous day's work. Then they're extremely small-scale, marginalized, self-employed, like the eBay person. And it's in effect the same kind of social location, it's just the most marginalized version of it, is the way I would characterize it. The fact that it's informal isn't the fundamental feature of it. The fundamental feature is that you're selling, it's a market form in which you have very minimal means of production to set yourself up as a individual seller within this market. A lot of these people, however, are in effect employees. I mean, in real terms, if you actually look at the relations, the wholesalers are really have a, you know, an entourage of people who do the selling for them, and it's more or less a fiction, this sense in which they're really self-employed. Yeah.
I just have one question with respect to child labor. That is one category of people who really cannot get, you know, I mean, inducted in any kind of class structure, to me it seems, because if we look at a category of child labor, many of them are in relation with industries as well as in their households. So the class relations that we're talking about can, to some extent, explain this relationship of the child with that of the industry, but it cannot fully explain the micro relations of production at home. For example, like in class counts, you have three, you said that, okay, so for the conditions of exploitation, there is material, so one's material welfare is dependent on the deprivation of the other. I think at both the cases of industry and the household, this applies for the child. And then exclusion from the productive resources, that also applies. However, the third point is appropriation of the fruits of labor by those who control the relevant productive resources. Now, for the industry, again, it applies. But I'm just wondering, at the household level, for the child and the child's labor, so do we understand that the parents have the control over the productive resources, which is the child himself or herself. Is that so?
So what you raised, I mean, that triggers a complex and really interesting set of questions around household production in general, of which child labor, where the child is working outside of the home in a carpet manufacturer or something, and the resources generated by that come back into the household, is an especially complicated set of relations. Some people argue that there's class relations inside of households, inside of families, where men are the exploiting class, women are the exploited class, and children may be dominated or possibly exploited, depending upon the nature of the production relations of domestic production. I have always been fairly skeptical of that formulation, of seeing what goes on inside of families as yet another arena of internal class relations as a general matter, not that it couldn't be relevant in some particular cases. Yeah, Johannes.
How you described it, it was even more like a like in slavery, that the parents own the labor of the child. And that's how it was actually in the past, that the slave belongs to a specific household and was part of it. And some argue that's why a slave is actually not as bad as being a wage earner. Because as a slave you belong to the household and you develop somehow with the household. It's often if you look into the past, wage earners often did worse than slaves. It was sometimes even worse for a slave to get a free person, because as a free person he had to drop himself on the labor market and had not the security of getting a job or not. While a slave, I mean, being a slave, okay, it's a problem, obviously. But the slave was part of the household, and by being part of the household, the slave owner had the responsibility also to keep the slave.
In the 19th century, once the international slave trade was cut off, and it never completely was cut off, but it was pretty substantially cut off by the 1820s, and the price of slaves went up. You know, they became more valuable. They weren't easily replaceable. Then the standards of living of American slaves quickly surpassed those of European workers in the industrial revolution, in terms measured by calories.
Right.
And it's not surprising. I mean, when slaves were easily replaceable, then there was less concern about doing this. Once they were not easily replaceable, then more resources had to be put into their own reproduction. And that's one of the reasons why it's sometimes argued that productivity on the plantations began to be eaten up by slavery itself. That is, the plantation had to become more and more responsible for the healthy reproduction of its own labor force. And as the market would fluctuate, it couldn't just suddenly fire the slaves. You know, it had to. It's as if you had a capitalist firm that wasn't allowed to fire its workers when you had a downturn. You know, if you needed a smaller crop, or you still had to support them, and you couldn't just let them starve because you couldn't replace them later. So slavery became more and more problematic once you eliminate the slave trade, the international slave trade, the infusion of slaves that you didn't have to raise from children. And so one argument is we didn't really need the Civil War to get rid of slavery. It would have been converted into sharecropping the way it was anyway. By the end of the 19th century. Yeah.
The problem I had with the economic side of that argument was that if it's really true that slave labor is so unproductive, and that in part it's because you get this unforeseen effect that slaves don't work as hard as you would like them to, and yet they still require a lot of care and upkeep. Why wouldn't this be simply compensated by the market value of slaves going way down? Then they're representing less capital, and there being more of an incentive to work them to death to extract profit from them.
Well, I'm sure there was fluctuations just at the equilibrium level became less profitable once the international slave trade was eliminated than before. And the people had these huge sunk costs, so the transition out of it isn't that easy.
It may have been more of a matter of the market and slaves in the American South not being perfectly competitive and not actually reflecting the market price of slaves, not actually reflecting all of those considerations.
Well, maybe. That's have we resolved enough around this self? I mean, we haven't nailed it down completely. I don't think. It's true that the data on places like Latin America and India and so on are often problematic because people haven't paid enough attention to how to locate people within different systems of production. But there's no problem. There's no fundamental problem here. You need to understand what are these different kinds of market economies. In typical developing countries, you have several different kinds of economic relations all interpenetrating. You have a subsistence sector in which people are not producing for the market at all. They're just producing for their own survival. A lot of what small farmers do is survive by producing for themselves outside of direct market relations. That's one of the kinds of social relations and economic structures. You have markets without employees. You have these various kinds of, usually called informal, because they're not heavily regulated. You have capitalist production. You have state production. And there's various other kinds of things. People combine these in their own lives at any given point in time. They certainly combine them over time. And I think if you wanted to locate self-employment, that's how you would do it. This would also, of course, affect the way you think about unemployment, because a lot of what we mean by unemployment is simply somebody's unemployed with respect to one of those economic structures, but perfectly active in others. This is a problem not just in third world countries. It's a big problem in the measurement of unemployment in Europe. European unemployment rates look high, but a lot of this is hocus pocus. I mean, it's not the case that in Spain, when the unemployment rates were 20%, that 20% of the labor force was literally not doing anything. They were just engaged in all sorts of other activities, generating income, which weren't reported, which wasn't part of the official statistics, and in which they continued to register for unemployment because there were various incentives to do so. So economic activity, in Italy it's estimated that a third of the GDP isn't counted. And that's a huge, huge part of the economy.
Especially in the South, yeah.
And you know that, you feel that when you go to a place like Italy, the standards of living just seem too high for the official data. You know, people are living better, they're dressing nicer than they should, given what the official statistics look like. And that's because a lot of activity. Perfectly well organized. It's not informal in the sense of chaotic. It's just not registered. Yeah, Adam.
Would you need to come up with a different typology to account for different types of production? I mean, so like the skills assets dimension might not be a useful means of differentiating people who are making a living in another way. I mean, even if participation in a market is like one component of it, and so they might have contradicting understandings, would you need to come up with another typology in which to place them?
In principle, you need a set of categories that are appropriate to each economic structure. Let me just give you one other recent example that I've been engaged in this, where I had a pretty sharp debate. It didn't actually get published for various reasons, but at the time of the transition in the Soviet Union from the old structure to the new structure, there were people who were eagerly engaged in studying social mobility, and they wanted to ask the question, has class mobility increased or decreased since the end of the command economy? And I posed the problem that the meaning of origins and destinations was very problematic when you go across such a huge structural transformation. Mm-hmm. And that it was, I felt, inappropriate to use the same categories. That is, you could do some discussion, you could use a stratification model. You could say mobility from the bottom 10% of the economic structure to the top 10%, is that it increased or decreased? You could do something like that. But to identify class categories, this is somebody using the Goldthorpe scheme, which we'll study in a few weeks, I didn't feel made sense, because the core of the Goldthorpe notion is the nature of the employment contract, which is what you use to define the categories. And the categories disappeared. There weren't the same categories afterwards. And so it didn't make sense to talk about mobility between homogeneous categories. Well, that's the same kind of issue here. You do need different ways of classifying people, of defining the class categories, because you have different class relations that you're defining. Okay, let's move on. We're done with item number one. We haven't directly discussed regular and irregular workers, although some of those themes. Well, let's briefly talk about that, because Eugene and Jorge both raised that issue. It's not completely separate from this unemployed discussion, but it has different properties, because the irregular regular worker distinction is still a distinction among employed workers. It's not a distinction between people who are outside of the employment relation. So why don't you pose the, each of you comment on that cluster of issues as you wanted to raise it.
Okay, I'm just concerned about the relation between regular workers and irregular workers in terms of exploitation. Let me suppose a sort of example. Here is a situation. The owner requires 10 hours work per day in order to get some kind of profit that they want. But through the some kind of collective bargaining or strike by their strong labor union, regular workers can reduce their working time to 8 hours per day. Then 2 hours of work, which originally the share of regular workers are transferred to irregular workers. So irregular workers work 12 hours or more per day. Even though this situation, regular workers increase their wage also through some kind of legal power, such as collective bargaining or something like that. So the owner necessarily reduced the wage of irregular workers. So in this situation, I'm concerned about that this relation can be referred as exploitation. I mean, this is not direct exploitation, but regular worker can use or something like the proof of labor power of irregular worker. So I just confused that.
Well, what I would like to stress in my generation are the consequence in class formation and class consciousness and class struggle of this division into outsiders and insiders in the labor market. So I think it's very important to understand these topics. I don't know if it's enough to include in the analysis of class structure and in the maps or in the class location maps, because one of the theoretical constraints to it is the existence of exploitation. So I'm not sure that there is exploitation between these kinds of workers about, depending on their employment. So I don't have a clear answer to my observation, but I think in the context, in the current context of Europe, it's one of the cases to understand the crisis of unionism and the situation of the working class movement, this division between insiders and outsiders.
So I think there's two kinds of things in play here. One is the word division. In order for it to have bite, does it need to be a division around the dimension of exploitation? Or are there other sources of cleavage, of division, of antagonism, of conflict among workers, for example, which could equally matter in terms of how it interferes with the formation of collectivities and could create strategic and other conflicts? Or when that really happens, is there lurking behind it something about exploitation? Is that, does a Marxian-inspired class analysis suggest that if ever you see a really robust division within workers, within the community of workers, that doesn't just dissolve in the context of social changes quickly, that is really a robust and durable thing, that it must be fueled by something connected to exploitation. That would be one sort of claim about the distinctive take that Marxists would have on this. And therefore, if there is a robust, enduring conflict between insiders and outsiders, regular and irregular workers, this must have to do with their locations with respect to the problem of exploitation. It wouldn't necessarily mean that one is exploiting the other. That one form that that could take would be privileged workers exploit underprivileged workers. But it would still, we would want to unpack it with respect to the problem of exploitation.
Well, your first point, race and gender can also create those same cleavages, and they have, at least in the, I only know about the U.S. labor market, so they have. So whether or not it's irregular versus regular or insider versus outsider, those also cleave, again, workers into opposing camps, which makes it sound as though when both Yugan and Jorge were describing these groups of workers, one group is exploiting the other group. And I don't understand why capitalists can't then be said to be exploiting both groups, and not exploitation in the way we've defined it by the three categories when exploitation is going on, but they are exploiting or using or abusing the inequality that I think boils down to economics to separate the two or the many groups into even greater divisions, so that rather than focusing on the capitalist who is really doing the exploitation, it deflects them into blaming each other. So and looks there. I mean when Yugan was talking about how if one group, if the regular group of workers is able to collectively bargain and shorten their day to 8 hours, knowing full well that there will be an irregular group of workers that will take up the slack and have to work 12 hours a day, that sounds as though they are absolutely benefiting from someone else's labor, because it enables them to work less. And so that is exploitative to me. But I think that there's, the reason they have to do that is because capital exploits both groups and pits them against one another.
I had a little bit similar argument, but I was just thinking of like this whole divide and rule policy. The non-coercive mechanisms, especially the legal mechanisms that we have in place, where, for example, strike is not allowed. And if there is strike, then the case of the reserve workers would come into play. Like, there was this huge thing about the pilot strike, right? And the next reserve workers had to come to work. Now, how do we conceptualize exploitation in that form, where there is no apparent, appropriation, but in fact, it's just a stemming. Like, how do we account for the non-coercive mechanisms, like the legal provisions, which hinders class formation and class struggle? And yes, there is class structure, and there is, for example, class consciousness. But the formation and the struggle is hindered through the non-coercive mechanisms of primarily capitalism.
Well, let me give a quick answer to that, but then return to this particular cluster that we were just talking about. There are lots of things other than class structure which affect class formation, the collective solidarities. There's a whole range of things. So the premise of class analysis of any sort, and certainly of Marxist class analysis, is not that once you get the categories of class right, you've solved the theoretical problem of explaining solidarities, class struggles. It's not the claim is not that class structure is a necessary and sufficient condition for particular class formations. The reason for worrying about class structure and trying to sort out the different kinds of relations and then understanding how individuals' lives intersect these structures. So we have these two tasks which come together, giving a nuanced map of the structure, which may include multiple overlapping structures and which define the positions filled by people, and understanding how people's lives traverse it. The reason for doing that is the belief that in order to understand how all these other mechanisms affect class formation, it is acting on those raw materials, the class locations of people and the class structures of which they're a part, is what gets formed into a class formation, and therefore it is a necessary starting point for that analysis, but not that it's a sufficient set of theoretical tools. Now, on this issue of regular and irregular workers as an example of a broad set of things, the traditional Marxian answer to this is to say what's really going on is differential exploitation of different segments of the working class, which then gets displaced into conflict between those segments. So you have advantaged white workers and disadvantaged black workers. Capitalists take advantage of that distinction in order to bring in black strike breakers when there's a strike, because the black workers are willing to do so. They're willing to do so because their opportunity set is much more restricted. And that then creates hostility between black and white workers. And the Marxian argument in general then is that the white workers are victims of the manipulations of capital, that divide and conquer is something driven by elite strategies, in which then workers fall to the temptation of buying into it and displacing their struggles, where they should really be joining with the black workers, unite and fight, black and white unite and fight, you know, the CIO, Communist Party, perspective on how black and white workers should join together. On the one hand, I think that's absolutely right. You know, I think that is true, that manipulation of divisions gets done for that purpose. On the other hand, it doesn't seem to me follow from that one should always then say that the privileges of advantaged workers are innocent with respect to conflicts of interest with disadvantaged workers, and that their efforts to protect those advantages have a certain autonomy with respect to deepening the disadvantages of others. And that given the time horizons for which a change in the structure would be needed, under which both groups would benefit, compared to the time horizons under which people act to protect their privileges, a lot of the political responsibility does rest on the shoulders, so to speak, of privileged workers for their defense of privilege, and that to have them do otherwise would be to ask them to make sacrifices. I mean, that's the key is, I think, if it is the case that for the privileged group of workers, they would have to make very substantial sacrifices of their own positions in order to forge the unity, and they refuse to do so, then they are protecting privileges from which they are getting advantages, even if it's also the case that capitalists benefit even more from that division. You know, that's why these are morally and politically complicated matters. The Marxian move to try to displace all of the moral responsibility for these situations onto the shoulders of capital is totally understandable. It's perfectly good and reasonable political and ideological strategies, but I don't think it's sociologically adequate as a way of understanding the actual dynamics on the ground when there are these kinds of conflicts. Now, whether that means we then want to say, yes, the conflict between insiders and outsiders, regular and irregular workers, should be thought of as a class conflict as opposed to a conflict between different subcategories within the working class, you know, that's a complicated matter. I partially have introduced the contradictory class location notion to do an end run around some of that rhetorical stuff by arguing that people can be both members of the same class and not, because they can have contradictory class locations. Now, whether or not the regular-irregular worker distinction should be thought of as a specific kind of contradictory class location issue, von Paris makes an interesting suggestion for why it should. That is, that when the expression regular worker really means that people have property rights in their jobs, that does imply that they have a different kind of class relation to employers, where employers have lost some of their property rights. They've been redistributed to workers. That is, one of the property rights that comes with owning the means of production is the right to choose who's going to use it. And they've lost that right when you have well-protected, legally protected workers. Workers, in a sense, that have a certain kind of ownership of the means of production. Not full ownership, but they own one crucial aspect of the means of the production, the right to set it in motion. And the capitalist no longer has the right to refuse to let them to do it. I mean, the capitalist could say, sit on the bench and don't actually use the lathe, I'll continue to pay you. Now, I think in all of these job protection, high job right protections, it's never the case that the employee actually has the right to insist to do the job. They just have the right to insist to be paid for doing the job. And the manager still can say, all right, I can't stand you. I can't stand the way you're doing it. I can't fire you. Sit in the corner. I don't believe the worker in Europe, in any European system, has the right to say, no, you have to let me use the machine.
He'll go to the union.
What?
Go to.
But he gets full pay. He just doesn't, he's just not required. I don't think that the union would force the employer to make him actually use the, but maybe, you know, maybe there's some cases. So when you have that strong a set of job rights, I'm, you know, fairly persuaded by von Paris's argument that really is a change in class relations. And what we now have is two varieties of capitalist class relations. It's still capitalist, but one in which there's been a redistribution of the relations of the rights and powers that come with the relations of production between capital and labor. It's not all the way to a workers' co-op, obviously. This is not a transfer of full property rights from capital to labor, but it's a partial transfer, and that's a different kind of class relation. And therefore, those workers and the irregular workers, if that's the correct description of the division, they do constitute different locations in the class structure, and therefore the conflicts of interests can be properly thought of as having a class character. That still doesn't answer the question of whether one exploits the other, but it does, I think, mean that these are different kinds of class positions. We have a few minutes left, and many items on the agenda. Why don't I just, let's see who hasn't participated much, or had their agenda item. So your agenda item hasn't gotten out. So which, you pick one that you'd like to.
Well, I guess I could talk about kind of what I wrote about my interrogation, and I was just trying to figure out where exactly qualitative or subjective based choices or actions on the part of people, where it came into the Marxist framework and where it fit into an analysis. You talked a lot about, in the Foundations piece, you talked a lot about the class, your class location determining then your choices and your interactions with other, you know, your social relations. And you also talked about, in I think Class Counts, about how Weber and Marx compare as far as Weberian analysis allowing for more subjective determinants of behavior, while Marx, you know, more on the historical materialism, and it's more objective based. So I was thinking, especially in reference to how we need to look at the middle class, you know, how do we explain variations in behavior that don't necessarily that are not necessarily allied with your class location or your privileged position? So I think it's important on how we locate the middle class, and especially for questions of class solidarity and class struggles, and where the middle class, being in such a murky space, where they may end up, and looking at people, why people either do follow or do act upon their interests, or may act against their own interests. So.
Does the issue clear? Adam.
So one thing I was wondering, and this gets to the issue with Weberian analysis. So I always wondered when I read this why the comparison is solely to Weberian class analysis and not necessarily to the status group alternative, which strikes me as a way of saying there are people that might not have structural predispositions by virtue of position in the market, but might behave in a particular way that might contradict kind of purely economic predictions. So, I mean, I thought that that was an interesting alternative that didn't come up as a comparison. So I always thought that Weber's argument on class was kind of more limited than his broader argument on status, which I thought was a more powerful alternative to his narrow class argument. Anyway.
Well, that, I mean, that's a theme when we discuss Weber in 2 weeks. One of the issues to think about is the relationship between Weber's argument about status groups and his argument about class, and whether these are really alternatives. That is, do we have to make a choice between them, or are these just different mechanisms through which human action gets organized and meanings get structured, in which they're both always present? And then precisely how did Weber think about their interconnection? The reason in the various things I've written on class that I was comparing it with Weber's view on class was that I did not intend to pose class analysis as an alternative to non-class analysis. That is, I'm not confronting, for example, how much about the world and what sorts of things can we explain by class compared to gender. Not that that's an irrelevant question, but my stand on that is that class and gender constitute different causal processes, and they interact in various ways, and if you're a class analyst, what you're interested in is understanding how this interaction occurs in order to increase your explanatory richness of your study of class, because that's what doing class analysis is. It's studying class and its consequences. And so it's not such an interesting thing to say which is better, class or status, as an explanatory variable. Although I have, when I was a graduate student, I engaged in that battle to some extent. But one candidate here then would, in terms of answering Charity's question, would be that it's status variations within classes that explain why there's so much variation in how people behave within a class. So status category, status groups could be one candidate for the answer about explaining variation. Raoul, were you no. waving your hand around? Does anyone else have any thoughts on this particular? Michael, you haven't said anything. Are you still there?
Yes.
I don't mean to put you on the spot. This isn't exactly the issue which you were raising in your memo, but...
I was a little curious on a similar topic, I guess.
Okay, so jump into the fray.
I'm also wondering when it comes to the question of exploiting the exploited, what sort of factors contribute to effective ways of that exploitation? If coercion doesn't work so much, maybe how do other kinds of control enter in? If maybe they're ideological, for example. The idea of being a good worker, or what other factors, maybe status factors, or something like that.
Well, Charity's question was about how do we explain people who act against or not in line with their own class interests? Sort of the example of the professor who supports workers, I think, was one that you.
Mm-hmm.
And you're asking the question: how do we explain people's responsiveness to non-coercive mechanisms of exploitation, so that people cooperate with their own conditions of exploitation, not because of the coercive threats which they face, but because of some sort of process which elicits their cooperation through consent.
Yeah, I also wanted to hold on to the possibility that a exploited worker who understands himself to be a good worker, who's responsible and goes to his job on time, maybe really is that. Just good and responsible and a hard worker. And maybe the question then would become, well, how did he get to that station of being someone who worries about pissing off his boss because he really cares what his boss thinks, as opposed to and not being the type of person who is just kind of naturally resisting the extraction of his labor effort. He thinks he's a really good worker, in other words.
This particular theme is one in the week when we discussed the moral significance of class with Andrew Sayers, very interesting book. This is really one of the ideas that's at the core of his work. And it does, I think, pose some very interesting, thoughtful challenges. Michael Burvoy, who's written a lot about how workers cope with the fact of having to work in dreadful and boring settings, is very concerned with what it takes for people to live a dignified life, a life in which they can feel good about themselves under those sorts of conditions. And one of the things which does matter to people is that they feel they're doing a good job. It's kind of abstracted from the relations under which they do it, but it's true throughout the history of capitalism that there's a culture of working class hard work that isn't Calvinist in the sense of just austerity and self-denial, but it's a question of pride in what one does, which is in tension with the fact that they're under someone else's control. And what Burvoy basically argues, in effect, not using quite this language, is that people, in a way, workers in the end kind of simulate what it would be like if they were really running the shop floor, and act in many ways the same way they would if they were the ones under control. They do so by forging all sorts of ways of cooperating with each other, of interacting with each other, that are not as stipulated by management, but which have the effect of actually increasing productivity, not reducing it. So Michael asks Burvoy in his wonderful book, Manufacturing Consent, he begins it by saying, industrial sociologists have always asked the question, why do workers shirk? Anybody who's worked in a factory thinks the real puzzle is, why do they work so hard?
Okay.
That the possibility of shirking are endless, and getting away with it is easy. You know, it's simple to work, to screw around in any big factory. The fact is that workers work pretty hard most of the time, and they discipline each other. They get pissed off at each other when some worker is really not doing their share. And the notion of doing a fair day's work is very deep in both in working class culture, but perhaps even more fundamentally in the human condition, to do a fair day's work. And the question is, do you get a fair day's pay? And a lot of industrial conflict comes from a belief that bargain is broken, that you're doing a fair day's work, but you're not getting a fair day's pay. So the kind of moral code, the moral order, is fragile. And that's bound up with this notion of consent and coercion within production, and it acts actually as a constraint on capital. I mean, it's a complicated matter. Employers who violate these normative orders end up shooting themselves in the foot. On the other hand, to live up to the normative order can be costly. And there's contradictory pressures. And that's why perfectly good firms go bankrupt, because they screw it up. They try to put the squeeze on workers and the thing blows up in their face. It's not so easy. My particular take on that, is just as a reiteration of my sort of fundamental point, it's not so easy fundamentally because exploitation gives the workers power. You know, they, it gives them the capacity to screw things up for employers through their control over their own expenditure of effort. Mm-hmm. Now, all of that doesn't directly answer the, you know, at least one aspect of charity's question about where does the source of variation come from. You know, some of this is just explaining more non-variation. You know, why do workers in general consent? Well, because of these kinds of moral, but it doesn't ask the question, why are some workers pains in the asses and others diligent? Why are some professors champions of working class struggles and others simply trying to advance their careers? I'm not sure Weber has anything to say about that either, frankly, about that kind of variation. Weber is always concerned with explaining types, not individual variations. We decided last time we were going to start a little late and a little bit later. What was our final? It's 4:10. I can tell the conference call has been on for exactly 2 hours, 1 minute, and 41 seconds. So I guess, I mean, there are plenty of other things on our list. I'd like to just before we break off, to ask a procedural question. I'm not giving heavy direction for how, you know, for moving on, marching down the list and so forth. I'm just sort of letting the discussion wallow around on topics for a while and then moving on. Is this about the right pace and coverage and sticking on things, or would there be some preference for more systematically moving down our agenda lists? Any thoughts on this? Yeah, Rahul.
I guess the one thought I have is that there are times when actually the in-depth discussions have been very useful, but I think what happens is that what becomes in-depth or what we actually cover is sort of random. So it seems that it might be a useful first step, at least for you to, you know, discard some things and distill a 3-point agenda instead of an 8 or 9-point agenda that we then work off of.
I have from time to time tried to do that, and there's two problems that it happens. One is I don't always know in advance what's going to click in terms of where people are coming from. I try to divine that from reading the interrogations, but it's often not so clear which themes and issues are going to actually start triggering lots of interesting discussion. And so I'm always a little nervous about cutting things out off of the agenda, which in the end would be really promising. The agenda is also a kind of guide towards what we were all thinking about, even if we don't get to it. So it has a certain function, even apart from directing our discussion. And the other thing is, this is more idiosyncratic perhaps, I'm really concerned about hurting people's feelings by, you know, not taking everybody's contributions as seriously as I can. And inevitably, if I were to try to consolidate this, then, and I don't mean that just in the sense that I'm nervous about being a nasty guy or something. I mean, I don't want to hurt people's feelings, because it's a bad thing to hurt people's feelings in this kind of context. I don't want anybody to have that sense that they're themes and concerns aren't being taken seriously, and that's the risk if I cut it back. That's why I shied away from doing that, although, you know, perhaps it would be a good idea sometimes. Yeah.
I think what is the most difficult is starting the whole class and then starting the different sections when we're moving on, because I feel like, I mean, like when you were asking me to start the discussion, partly I wasn't expecting it, but I find what I wind up doing is like sort of reiterating what I wrote, which isn't necessarily the best entry point for a discussion, because that was a particular way of articulating a concern that's not necessarily the easiest for other people with other concerns to figure out their concerns relationship to. So I'm not sure what is the solution to that, but I think like it seems like it takes us a little while sometimes to get to a conversation.
Yeah, I think that's right. And one solution to that could be for me to play that role at the beginning, to kind of try to distill from the various themes something a little more programmatic from to which people could respond. That has more the character of me giving introductory comments, which I've tried, which I like to avoid. It's not out of worry about the extra preparation time that involves. It's just wanting this to more spontaneously emerge out of the agendas that get set up. Would it help if I were to decide ahead of time exactly what's coming first? I mean, I guess you could divine it because it's at the top, but actually letting a couple of people know that I'll start with that item and you should come prepared to say something, or is that just going to... Well, I mean, if there's no great unhappiness with how things are going in terms of getting the conversation launched, I guess it is, you know, it's true almost always at the beginning of the semester that the very beginning of each seminar is a little bit hard to get something really firing going, although we got going pretty quickly this time. Okay? All right. So next Tuesday, Ernst Fehr's talk is at noon. I will, which I need to go to, and it's in the psychology building. And I assume there'll be others, some of you, that will want to be there as well. It might mean, therefore, that we will be starting more like the genuinely at a quarter after. I mean, I'll get this all set up before I go, but it may take us a little longer.
General, is it still the case that you have to leave earlier? Is it still the case that you have to leave exactly at 4:15? There was one person
here.
Yeah,
I have a class at 4:15.
Ah, okay.
So,
okay.
But sometimes I can stay.
Michael and Fabian, I think we're done.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
thank you.
And now I'll see if we actually recorded this, then I'll put it up online if I did.
Great.
I don't know if it worked. Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, let's see what happens here.